Good morning, folks. Tom Ivester, an alcoholic. And I'm back. Florida people, we were talking about Florida people are brilliant because they sure know how to get their money's worth. Yeah, I had a $250 ticket, and I've been talking ever since Wednesday. My God, I'm in a time warp. But now I'm not exhausted from all that. My ankle kind of blew up last night, double size, and so I'm going to get this big weight off of it and just sort of sit down and visit. What I would like to do is just sort of talk with you about concerned member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's who I am. Not an authority on anything. You never do want to hear somebody start out apologizing or saying, I'm not much of a speaker and, you know, all this stuff. And I didn't know I was doing this till I got here. And I never figured out what it was till right about now, you know, exactly what we're doing. Bob gave me a little rundown. And so when there's a vacuum, you just step in and fill it. And so I just sort of made up my mind what I thought needed to be talked about a little bit. I only had about 15 minutes to prepare this morning, plus 51 years. So I had plenty of time to prepare. What I want to talk about is, and I'd really like to talk with you, we're not going to have the mic because we've got a little emergency deal with that, so we won't be able to put it out. It's got to go to another location before we finish. But still, we can make it interactive. And I love interactive workshops because I think it just multiplies the value. You know, one-way communication is not efficient, not effective. My folks that I've read that study communication say that one-way communication, like if I just preach to you, 2 weeks later you won't remember 2% of it. Not remember the title of the workshop. Most of the time, by the time you get out the door, you say, what was that he was talking about? Yeah. So it just doesn't stay very well. And then when it's interactive, it goes up quite a bit to 35-40%. And then when you get involved in doing it, like I hope we'll do, it'll go up around 80. And that's why I like interaction, not just so we hear the stuff back and forth, but because it increases the effectiveness. And so what I want to beat around this morning is this, not so much the title of this is Institutions and Treatment. Well, there are a lot of institutions in the world. Corrections is one of them. But I'm going to slide around corrections, and we'll visit it whenever it comes up. But I've beaten on that drum pretty good since I've been here. Some people are punch drunk from having me beat on it so much. And I want to broaden that out a little bit and think about the various places that people wind up in captivity. And they do. And there's not a heck of a lot of difference between the confinement of a treatment facility. The facility's a little nicer. But when you're taken away, there was a lady who was the, bless your heart, thank you very much. You're a good man. I don't care what they say, you're a good man. There was a lady that was a commissioner of corrections in New York. Years ago, she was doing a speech somewhere, and somebody said, do you think prisoners are getting too soft? That's something you hear all the time. And she said, no, not really. She said, if I was given a suite in the Waldorf Astoria, I would love it with free room service and all of that kind of stuff. I would love it for about 2 weeks, and then I'm wanting out of there. Now that thirst for freedom exists with every human, no matter where we are. And so I want to broaden this out and talk about places where alcoholics wind up. And more important, a relationship between where alcoholics wind up and us. I don't know if I'm right or wrong, but I'm not saying this because I'm in Florida, but I have an impression that service and structure and functionality of those is in better shape here than the average place. Now, Northern Illinois is another one where that's a very much a fact of life, but I have an impression. But nonetheless, you know, that I know you have some of the same kind of problems everybody else does. So I want to just sort of beat on those a little bit. I like to share experience and examples. I don't like to lecture. And just talk about some areas where, I think I've got four targeted. One's medical. Treatment groups, the relation between treatment groups. I want to kick off with that. And then the medical, and then lawyers. I know you won't believe that lawyers get in trouble, but once in a great while they do. And so I want to talk a little bit about their cage. And probation and court type of stuff. You know, that awful lot of alcoholics get caught up in that and wind up with those wonderful little pieces of paper that they have to beg somebody to sign. And I want to hit on anonymity just a little bit. Well, yeah, a little bit, but I want to hit it hard anyway. And then lastly, I want to give you some homework. And now, you don't have to take it, but I'm going to give it to you anyway, if you're still here. And ask you to do something when you get back to where you live, you know, not just leave it in Fort Lauderdale. So with that said, I'll get off at it. And any time we're going, just give me a signal, but state a question real quick, because I have a short memory. But state it real short and sweet, and then I'll repeat it so that it's on the recording. That's important, because recorders are useless if you only hear one side of the conversation. Yeah, so that'd be the ground rules then. And in treatment in groups, I won't elaborate on this nearly as much. I normally talk about 3 hours about this by itself if I'm doing a workshop. But in this, I was around when we had no treatment. I mean, none. And I was here when it started to emerge. You know, at first it was just some distant news about something that was going on somewhere called Minnesota, wherever that was. You started to hear about the slow development of treatment. And I was thrilled to know it was there. I mentioned the other night, I had the experience of holding a guy in my arms on a 12-step call while he died. And I didn't know what to do with the guy. There was nothing to do with him, except hold him, did that. But I remember those days. And if you remember those days, you can't help but have gratitude for the fact that today, there's some jeopardy for it, but today, treatment is still fairly reliably available around the country. At one time in this country, I would have never believed it, but treatment was available anywhere in this country, almost on demand. I never thought I'd see a day like that, but I saw it. And I'm thankful for it. But like anything, you can always find a little bad news if you look for it. And treatment, there were byproducts of that have had some real impact on our fellowship. And I won't elaborate on them too much, but I think you'll catch what I'm talking about pretty quickly. You know, one of the things that happened when treatment came into being, you could pretty safely predict that if a treatment facility opened up in a town, the number of AA meetings would double almost overnight. And when you think about it, you can see why. You know, with that battle cry of 90 meetings in 90 days. Well, if you only got a half dozen meetings, you're going to have a hard time making 90 in 90. And so people started putting together groups. And they were much like aftercare groups, you know, where basically come together, how you doing, how's your day going, what's happening, you know, served a purpose. But they became one-dimensional kind of groups, you know, and so they just proliferated. And it just, you know, on the face of it, it looks real good. But there's some downside to it. Because what you wind up with is, and it's characteristic of the country now, is that we are dominantly a fellowship that's made up of one-dimensional groups where the agenda is recovery, period. Period. And rarely gets into anything like unity or service. And they just, you know, tend to be they'll operate a lot of times at the level of convenience. So you can get to it quick, get out quick. And they're I'm sure they serve a useful purpose. But the purpose is confined to the meeting itself. Nothing precedes it. Nothing follows it. There's a group of people come together to support each other, encourage each other. Very good. But nothing ahead of it, nothing behind it. You know, so the legacies of getting out, you know, I'm a little suspect of that kind of a thing, because I don't think you treat a self-centered condition by self-focus on self. And somewhere along the line, you got to grow out of that and get out of your shadow. And so, but they're a product of what happened in treatment. And again, I won't elaborate on it, but I mentioned the other night about the numbers of alcoholics and then Al-Anons and then Alateens at this conference. The number of alcoholics here is totally impressive. The number of Al-Anons is dismal. It is dismal. And the number of Alateens is embarrassing. And for a family illness and a family program of recovery, those are very troubling indicators for me. I hope they are for you, because I do believe it's a family illness and that recovery is a family matter. And part of the product, part of the reason for that product is the proliferation of those one-dimensional groups. If you think about how a typical meeting, you've been to them just like I have, typically a meeting like that, where would the family get in? How would they ever get any acquaintance with the program? You know, families basically spectator and often see themselves as victim of those things. And so it sort of narrows down the focus beyond where we want to comfortably be. So it's a good news, bad news thing. Thank God we got treatment. But with it, we got some things that pose some real challenges. I'll just tell you one other dimension of that, and I have to watch it because I get interested in my examples. And I relive the things, you know. One of the products of that, and you may not see this in Florida, that I'd really like to know, but if you look across our country, including my state, let me put it this way. In 1955, Bill Wilson, the remaining co-founder in St. Louis, Missouri, did something that was monumentally significant in the history of our fellowship. He said, "I quit." No, he didn't say that. No, he said, "I'm turning the fellowship over to the membership." And what was set up was what we call the inverted triangle, eh? You know, with the recovery and unity and service. And the whole notion was that the grassroots membership ought to be the driving force in how we do business in AA. That's a wonderful concept, but it's not much of a reality. Because the fact is, in much of the country, and I hope it's different here, when we assemble to have that process work so that the group conscience drives what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, in my state, we wind up with somewhere around 22 or 23% representation. You see what that does to a group conscience if we want the conscience of Alcoholics Anonymous in my state? You know, I check everywhere I go to find out, you know, if those numbers are constant around the country. Some places they're not all that constant. Northern Illinois is one that stands pretty tall. I talked with the chairman of the board of the General Service board. We did a workshop together up in New Jersey, and he was a guy that had the view much wider than mine. And so I told him what my view was of this, and I said, "I hope to God you could tell me something different, because you see the rest of the country. You see it far more closely than me." And he said, "I wish I could." And so it's a problem. It's not just a matter of my values. It's a matter of our whole design for function. And so what we wind up with, rather than an expression of a group conscience that drives a fellowship, we wind up with a minority opinion. Then we demonize the folks that are in the minority by calling them politicians and this kind of stuff. If somebody said the other day an amen to it, you know, what they are is people who are willing to belly up and pick up the load and do something. Thank God for folks that step forward. So it's a thing when you look at the institution of treatment is a good friend, but the byproduct of that contributes to what I think is a huge problem in our fellowship. And I really would like to get to skinny on what's going on. It's none of my business, y'all. Yeah, it is some of my business. Yeah, what you do here affects my welfare. And so if you hold a flag high, heck, we may get ours up a little bit. You know, so anyway, I'd like to get to skinny on that before I get here about the state of the art here. So that generally is sort of an environment that we're working in. The medical thing, I don't know if you've ever worked with docs or not. It's a strange thing. The history of our group, we have all the service committees that exist in AA functional in our groups. We have organized committees just like a district or area or general service anywhere else. And we are an action oriented, service oriented group. We've had four CPC chairs in our history of 11 years. All four have been medical docs. Now, that's not the recruiting criteria, but yeah, it's a funny thing. If we do something one time, it becomes a sacred tradition. So now we have to recruit, sober up a drunk so we can replace our CPC chair. Now we got a brand new one we're training right now. And working with docs is... It's an interesting experience, to say the least. My son's one, so I can talk rather freely about it. But first one we had, I'll tell you real quick, I think he makes the point. I'm lying when I say quick, but first one I had, there was a guy came into town. He was sober, sort of. And he wasn't drinking, I'll put it that way, but he was still in orbit. And was zooming around the field. He couldn't quite get landed, but he was in traffic pattern. And I started sponsoring the guy. And you talk about a loose cannon. He became our first CPC chair. An interesting man. I tried to give him some latitude. You don't let him get out because we had a bunch of stuff going on. I didn't have time to bird dog him too much. He had a radio program going on. And so he'd tell me about it. I never had gone on it with him, but I said, tell me how that thing's going. He said, oh, man, it's going great, man. We got people there. We'll have three or four people every time we go in there, and we answer questions and stuff. And I said, who are you taking? Well, my God, he was taking people less than 60 days sober. I mean, by God, he's still shaking. And he put them on. I said, no, we don't want to put those guys on national TV that quick. Hold off, you know, but I'd rather have to say whoa than giddy up. And so you got to channel that energy. But God knows he was dangerous. He came to me one day and said, can we do a television program in our group? I said, no, idiot. You know you can't do a television program in an A group. And he said, no, I don't mean during the meeting. He said, but I'd like to just come in. He was one of those community docs, you know, on the cable TV that talks about, you know, nose broker, ingrown toenails or something. But they got those things going on. And he said, what I'd like to do is bring the cameraman that puts me on TV, put four of our members with their back toward the camera and talk about the program. And I said, I knew if you talk long enough, you'd finally make sense. Let's do that. And he did put on a great program. I was telling him, a buddy, that one of the people on that television program now living in Florida up at the Villages and having a great time. We live in a small community. Everybody knows everybody. And she was sitting there. She changed her name like her neighbors wouldn't recognize her. But anyway, it worked out well. But he was that kind of a fellow. And one day, he was anxious. He was an anesthesiologist. And one of his problems was he kept getting himself mixed up with the patient an awful lot. And so he had been barred big time from his profession. And you talk about it, the guy's trained his whole life to get into a profession, and he's barred from it. And so he was moaning the blues one day, and he said, "Man, I will never get back into my profession." He was up to bedpan jockey, I think. He was practicing, but not much. And I said, "No, you're going to be all right with it." And he was petitioning every other day to the board, you know, to let him in. I said, "Quit pleading your case. And when you write to those folks, teach them about alcoholism. Teach them about recovery. Don't plead your case. And watch what happens." You know, sure enough, he got his license back. You know, started to practice. And one day he came. This is the sticky part. One day we were meeting. We always met over at the Holiday Inn and had breakfast. And I said, "Well, big guy, this is a big day for you coming up." He said, "What?" You know, he was always acting like he was amazed at everything. He said, "What?" I said, "It's your second anniversary." And he said, "Oh, my God, I can't be there." I said, "Well, that's too bad. Where you got to be?" He said, "Well, you know the medical board owns me. And they have my life in their hands, and I absolutely have to be at an annual meeting." And I said, "Well, that's too bad. But it certainly tells me what the agenda will be for our next meeting." And he said, "What's that?" I thought I was going to give him good news. I said, "It'll be about priorities." And he said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, what it means is when the things that come to you as a result of your recovery become more important than what produces your recovery, your priorities are shot." Well, he was not a dummy. Yeah, he just turned gray. He said, "Oh, my." And he said, "I'll be there." He came in that night in a tux with a zebra cummerbund. I can still see him in a zebra tie. So I introduced him to everybody as the offspring of a penguin and a zebra. You know? But he went on and got his thing done. And I tell you one other thing about it. He's a fascinating guy. He's doing wonderful work. He's in another state now. CPC chair there, too. He's going to be that in perpetuity, I think. But one other night, I'll tell you one other thing, and it's where the wicket really gets sticky. We were talking one night after the meeting, and he looked at his watch. He said, "Oh, I got to go." And I said, "Where are you going?" "It's 10 o'clock at night." He said, "Where are you going?" He said, "I got to go over to Rogers." I said, "What for?" He said, "I got to get a specimen." I said, "Whoa, well, you got to do what?" He said, "I got to get a specimen." And I said, "No, you don't. No, you don't. You're Rogers' sponsor, not his monitor. You don't get a specimen. Yeah, he can do something else with it. You know, whatever he wants to, throw it out, but not you." And he said, "Well, my God, what am I going to do? I'm under orders from the commission, the board, to take the specimen." I said, "You call whoever the fellow in charge is and tell him that you cannot take the specimen." And he said, "Well, he's going to want to know why." I said, "Tell him that your sponsor said you cannot take the specimen." But you think about the bind that's involved in that, eh? Now, here's a guy whose career that he's invested his life in is in jeopardy. But if I let him do it, his recovery is in jeopardy, eh? And so you know, have to hold the line, you know. And so it's one of those sticky things when we start working with other folk to understand how to help people get out of that maze, because that is a tough place to be tied up, and you can't just you know, I think you understand what I'm talking about, but that's good. The lawyers. And don't hesitate to jump in now. If you want to just share something or question or challenge or whatever, feel free to do it. I'll tell you about lawyers. I know they got a nice name for it, but I call it the drunk lawyer program. And they've got, like every profession, has a captivity program where they capture wayward people in their field. And then they start mandating them into the stuff to do, into treatment, and then when they finish treatment, mandate them into some of the aftercan programs defy imagination. You know, I had one lawyer that called and he said, "I got to do something, man. They got me in jail with the help." You know, and he was going to psychiatric counseling, marriage counseling, personal counseling, AA. You know, I mean, he didn't have time to go to court because he was so busy with all of the stuff he was mandated to do, and he's going nuts. And ran into the same thing there. I had an opportunity. I spoke at the convention of judges in North Carolina. No, lawyers, not judges another time, but lawyers in North Carolina. Had dinner with the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and two other justices and a couple of other lighter weight judges. Yeah, but now me sitting there at the banquet table with those dudes was a little extraordinary in itself. And when I got up to speak, I did normal kind of how-do-you-do stuff and tributes to everybody in the world. And then I said, what an honor it was to have dinner with the chief and the other justices there. And I said, if we'd have had dinner a few years ago, it would have been for my last meal. he didn't know what I was talking about, the chief justice. I knew him professionally, but he didn't know that my history had... He didn't know what I was talking about until later on, but we remained pretty good friends. But there is something. And in the course of that, some of them knew of my interest in lawyers, you know, in some of the travail. And so they asked me if I would stick around and listen to some of their interaction. You know, they're just like us. They break up into work groups and into study sessions and stuff like that. And I said, yeah, sure, and I'll sit around. They just wanted me to sit there and then give them feedback on what I observed. Well, what I saw was a bunch of people wandering in the mist. I saw a group of people wandering in the gray zone with no real clear definitive guidelines for anything. They were using, just like the docs, a lawyer who had started in recovery to sponsor and monitor the next one out the gate. Well, I would submit to you that sponsor, monitor are mutually exclusive terms. They don't go together. They're absolutely in conflict, and I don't think it can work. And so what they had was just these bunch of guys, and I knew many of those guys. They were good buddies in the program, but they were caught up in that foggy thing about, you know, where does helper and keeper and all of this stuff shake out. And later on, I saw the just happened to run into a guy at a luncheon that was the head of that program, an Al-Anon guy. And he was the director of that drunk lawyer program. And he said, well, what are you doing now that you're retired? And I said, well, I'm managing to stay busy. And I said, as a matter of fact, one thing I'm paying attention to is what you're doing. And he said, how's that? And so I told him what my concern was. And he said, God knows, I'm glad to hear you say that because I'm concerned about it. I said, well, do you ever get phone calls from lawyers that are lost in this process? He said, Tom, I spend every day of my life on the telephone with people lost in this process. And he said, what do you think we could do about it? Now, I'm a pretty simple type of fellow. I'm not an idiot, but I keep things pretty simple. I want it ground level so I can understand it. And I said, well, right off the top of my head, if I was going to try to do something with you, I'd get a table and I'd put some of you guys on one side and some of us on the other side, and then we would try to figure out how to make a handoff. And he said, the only thing I'd ask is be sure I'm at that table. And now we're sitting at that position right now. The lawyers in my state are, I don't know about all the lawyers, but the people who are caught up in trying to make this thing work are enormously interested. We have standing invitations right now to speak to the conference of every level of judges in North Carolina. We have agreement to start. You know what the holdup is? If when you're going to set up a program, you've got to have the resources to deliver. And I'll let you in on a little secret, you know, where that thing I opened with comes into play. We have pretty big areas of our state where there's not a real three legacy group within driving distance, where sponsorship doesn't even have much meaning. You know, any of the legacies, it's just the kind of thing I decide, where people just talk, look after me and go home. Well, if you're going to try to deal with a challenging situation about how to help a professional get out of the trap and the maze and into a role, you've got to have some ready warriors. And so what we're looking for now is a point where we can reliably deliver on what needs to be delivered. So we're the holdup. We're the holdup. And so our CP folk around the folks are looking for this kind of thing. But it's just one example, you know, of why, you know, institutions that are geared to help can wind up being traps, you know. And the missing thing is often us that's missing. I tell you something, it's just my own evaluation of it, but right now, generally, I think we have the lowest level of respect in the professional community that I've ever seen. And the primary reason, if it's true, is we're missing. We're missing. You know, very, very rarely, you know, are we reaching out and setting up deals so we can have cooperative relationships. That's what CPC means, cooperation. That means working together. We don't normally have that. You know, we're missing in action on that to a great extent. On a lot of standards. I'll give you one other example. It veers away just a little bit. But I was out in somewhere in the Bay Area of California, doing a retreat with a bunch of guys that were in my sponsorship line, and they wanted to enhance their spiritual life. They wanted to enhance their usefulness and grow. So that's what we're doing. And there were four guys came in from Hollywood. They were just wanting to go somewhere and have fun. They weren't trying to demonize anything, but they were just wild, crazy young guys from Hollywood, and they wanted to just sort of harass the old bleeding deacons on the mountain. And I played with them for just a few minutes, and then but I didn't play the game, you know. And so they finally caught on. We were not going to have a frivolous agenda. We were going to talk. And then when they settled down and started to engage rather than just have party, they were pretty thoughtful guys. One of their concerns was this sort of musical celebrity rotation of well-known people through rehabs and captivity and all that. And it so often just winds up being headlines and on every expose program you see. And it's a sad, sad thing when you see how that's treated. And the product of that is not just the tragedy of what happens to the individual. It's a tragedy of what happens to us. Because what we do is become the punchline on jokes in the late night shows. He's not intended to be the butt of jokes. But when we get caught up in that thing, and you know, what's missing is anonymity, eh? Anonymity, spiritual foundation of our whole thing. And so we wind up being the butt of jokes. That isn't exactly where we want to be. And so the guys brought that up and said, what do you do about something like that? I said, well, let me just ask you a question. I said, how long has it been since somebody from AA has met with the editor of your paper or television station and explained the criticality of anonymity? I could have answered my own question. It wouldn't have been in the memory of anybody in the group, I guarantee you. I'd ask you the same question. How long has it been since somebody in your community has met with somebody in the media to talk about the criticality? You know, we make a noble effort. General Service Office send out a letter if there's an anonymity break. You know how much people read junk mail. That's very effective. And they'll get the delegate to go over and take a beating. But what really counts is when a human being sits down and talks about the criticality for a human being trying to recover. You know, we tend not to do that. You know, and that's a critical kind of thing. And so a lot of people get trapped, you know, in various kind of ways. And we're the only guys in town that can deal with that very effectively. We just had a case in North Carolina that one of those tragic things that happened. There was boy meets girl on the AA campus, and a couple of newcomers got connected, and it wound up the guy killed the girl. There's no such thing as a murder that's not brutal, but this was a especially brutal murder with a crush your head with a rock and so it's just all over the headlines, you know, all over the paper, describing the crime and describing how they met at an AA meeting, and it sounded like that's what we assigned as field work or something. But it's just a terrible kind of an article. Well, I was debating about what on earth do you do? You can't just publicly attack. They don't know any better. How long has it been since anybody's explained to them about the criticality? The next couple of days later, a writer for the paper, I don't know him, but a writer for the paper wrote an extremely, we wasn't challenging that article. You know, a newspaper has to deal with the public's right to know. They're not violating the canons of their ethics. They're not violating that. They have a responsibility to report the news, and I understand that. And so this writer that followed up that bad news deal wrote a very sensitive article about what happened. Well, I wrote a commendation to the paper. Commendation to him, but I made sure his boss got a copy of it. Because, just supporting a positive action probably delivers a stronger message than just trying to get them to conform. So anyway, I just mentioned that because when these things are going on, you know, CPC can be an excellent tool for reaching in and engaging and establishing cooperative relationships and understanding. You know, very vital stuff. Give you one other one that. And all this is leading up to homework now. there's a lot of stuff. We've almost resigned to it now, but we got into a thing of having people mandated to AA and then having to bring little pieces of paper in and get somebody to sign them. I never did like that process, and I wouldn't sign the slips. But I have never one single time embarrassed the guy with the slip. You know, if he'd come and ask me, I'd say, no, Bob will take care of that. You know, I'd wimp out because I didn't like to do it. Bob might not mind. And so I'd just wimp out and I'd say, no, he'll take care of that, you know. So I wouldn't sign it, but I would never offend a person because the person with the slip is the guy's caught in the middle. They don't beat up on him. But that was troubling to me. That's a terrible way to treat a drunk. And that was the reason I would back off. And if you think about that, think back to our history. You know, Gail did a great job with showing the women behind the scenes and often in the scenes. And that history is so important. But think back to the origin of AA. Think back to Abby Thatcher and Roland, the guy who went to the court. Went to the court and said, hey, judge, let us work with him. Well, God, the judge had nothing to lose. But contrast that to what we do today. Contrast that. We're 180 degrees in the other direction. We still revere that judge that turned Abby over to somebody. We don't even know him. But we revere that guy. Today, we scorn because of this trafficking of people in AA. But, well, we've done that 180. And so now what we've got is courts mandating this kind of activity. Well, there have got to be better ways to do it. I think you see. Well, I'll give you one example. I walked into... I won't identify the location, but it was a very historic place in AA. I walked in, I was going to catch a meeting. I was in that city, They had a big sign on the front door. It didn't say, "Welcome, last stop on the bus line, glad you made it." Yeah, it didn't say that. It said, "We do not sign papers." Is that how we want to welcome people to Alcoholics Anonymous? Here's what we are against, you know. I just got cold when I read that thing. But that's what we've come to. You know, we sort of get frustrated and aggravated, and we come back with that kind of stuff. Well, you know, I'm the kind of guy that I like to try to solve stuff. I don't like to just moan and groan. I do a lot, but I guarantee you I'm working too while I'm doing it. And so I wanted to do something about that. I never did know exactly what to do. You can't attack the whole court system. But you can do something. I'm on the corrections committee in my group. I just got elected to chair it. I told the group I ran unopposed and won by one vote. That was a lie, but it was a good story. we had a corrections meeting and we had just a couple minutes at the end of the meeting, and I said, "Guys, let me just ask you something." And I said, "You know, that paper signing thing bugs me. I said, how about if we try to do something about it?" And a guy I sponsor, a 44-year guy, said, "Oh, hell, Tom, we can't do anything about that. They do it all over the country." I said, "Well, let's don't tackle the whole country. Let's just deal with Mayberry here and see what we can do with this." And he said, "Ah, well, we can try." Well, I took that, remember that doc? It was so goofy. His first CPC assignment was to go solve that problem. Now, I went with him, but that was his first coup. And so I didn't exactly know how to attack it. But the people who really manage that program in our state are probation people. Now, judges are the power behind it. But judges don't pay much attention to that. You know, they ring the gavel and somebody else runs off and does something. So I never had figured out why I didn't like that. You know, what it bugs me about it. Now, I do my best thinking when I'm up. That's why pilots are so righteous. They up next to God, you know. And so I'm flying somewhere and I'm thinking about that. And I started writing the old advantages, disadvantages. You know, why would somebody do this? And I did my best to be generous with it. I thought up 10 reasons why somebody might think that's a good idea. All 10 of them were valuable to the probation person. None were clearly valuable to the client, to whatever you call them, the paper carrier, the client. And I put a question mark by 3 because maybe in some future millennium it could be helpful. But I didn't really think any of them were helpful. On the other side, I think I listed 26 things that were absolute negatives about that. And I don't have my stuff. If I'd have known I was going to do this, I'd have brought that and let you see what they look like. In fact, if anybody wants it, I'll email it. Now, I'm not going to lick stamps. Man, before I got a computer, I licked so many stamps, my tongue was a foot long. And so I'll email it to you. But it was just about what you would expect. You know, the guy comes in branded. You know, he might as well have a brand on his forehead. You know, I'm not like you. You know, I don't mean to be here. They sent me. He's a second-class citizen when he walks in the door. Then he's got to get somebody to I couldn't think of any good thing. The one thing on there that I wrote down that I had never really thought about of why I wouldn't do it was that when I sign that paper, I become something other than another alcoholic to that guy. I become a validator, an inspector, a certifier, an extension of the probation system. We have a tradition that calls that affiliation. Because that's what I am. When I sign it, I'm an official validator for the probation system. And I don't want to be that. I want to be another alcoholic to that alcoholic. And the minute I saw that, I saw why I would send the guy to Bob. I'm not going to do that. So we did that thing, went over and met with the director of probation in our piece of the state. Nice man. Typical kind of a guy in an agency. He was back behind a big desk in a defensive position because he knew we were going to attack him about something. And so he's standing back there very guarded, sitting back there guarded. And if we hand wrote this, yeah, this was not the Magna Carta. This was a handwritten stuff. I had my wife to rewrite it, thank God for her, so he could read it. But that's what we used. It wasn't well done, but the thoughts were well done. And so we got to that, and he got to the one I was just talking about how it changes the nature of who I am. He said, "Damn, I never thought about that." I said, "Me either. Me either. But I was up there next to God. He told me to tell you that." No, I didn't tell him that. But yeah, I think I did tell him that. But anyway, Bob says I'm getting close on time. That's well, I saw him look at his watch. You got to make quick moves out here. But we got from that point on, man, we were a team. Yeah, I mean, we were together. Cooperation. We weren't just there to dump a problem. You know, I believe when you go in to do a cooperation with a CPC project, don't ever lay down a problem without laying down a solution with it. It's not fair. Yeah. And it's not smart either. Because I guarantee you, if you let them come up with a solution, you won't like it. They don't think the same way we do. They're in a different program. They're trained differently. They're not going to see it the way we do. And so we couldn't have been in more agreement. He said, "My God, yeah, we need to do something about that." And he asked us to meet with the rest of the probation team and just sort of let them know about it. That we would have officers come over, invited to our meeting, two at a time, so they wouldn't be lonely. But not packing. If they're packing, don't send them, you know, because some of our people are still nervous. And so we don't want to be getting the rods in there. And great agreement, you know. And that's been probably 10 years. Haven't seen a slip of paper since. We didn't negatively do anything. Well, we laid out, you know, we had laid out a half a dozen ideas that could do. The one they bought, you know, about, you know, what are the solutions there? The one they bought was put the responsibility on the client. It's his problem. Let him tell you what he's going to do. Don't you tell him what to do. Then waste your time chasing him. Think you're going to catch a drunk. Jeez, I mean, it was just stupid. When you back off and look at it. And that's what they agreed to. It's his problem. It's his program. If it makes sense, stamp it and say, "Yeah, man, go for it." If you want to verify it, let him tell you how he's going to verify it. Why are you going to take responsibility from him? You know. So, I mean, it's a simple example of something that makes a big difference. You know? People ask me if we still get people from probation. I am absolutely delighted to tell you that I don't know. It's none of my business. What do I care where somebody comes from? What's that got to do with anything? So I don't know, and I am just grateful that I don't know. Let me just jump to. We could go all day. I only got about six more pages of notes, but let me jump on to homework. And now, obviously, I'm just using a term here but I'd like to just get you to think about something. When you go back to where you live, you know, I mean, you don't have to tackle all of Miami. That might be a bit of a challenge. I heard that would be a little bit of a challenge. So don't tackle all of it. But pick out a piece of where you live. There's some little chunk where you feel some connection and responsibility. And think about places where alcoholics hit the wall and then stand there mystified about what to do. And realize that the person who's in charge of that wall probably is equally mystified. I tell you what got me thinking about it. I was over for a detox deal at the hospital, and it's in what they call the behavioral department, you know, which It's a nice way of saying we're in with psychos and everything else. We're in that department. And detox is a part of the charge there. And the director of behavioral services, or whatever you call it, happened to be there. And so I was asking her about, they'd shut down a treatment program because of funding and stuff like that. And their detox population was a little low. And I said, what's the problem? I mean, I know the problem's not getting any smaller. What's the problem with the census? And she said, it's money. So many people don't have coverage. And we can't afford to just take in cases. And I said, well, what happens if somebody comes to the admission point and they have no coverage? And she says, well, we can't take them in. I said, well, where do they go? And now, this is a highly trained professional woman, but it's a different level than she works. And she stood there for a minute and she said, you know, I don't know. I don't know. But that's what I'm talking about. That's a simple kind of a deal, eh? But that's a life and death kind of a thing. We got somebody at a critical point trying to find some help, and what you wind up with is mystified people standing there. So think about places where folks hit the wall. You know, obviously hospitals is top of the line, but how about driver's license things? How about Social Security or social services type thing where families are devastated? What about ministers? You know, last two 12-step calls I had came from ministers. You know, that's where people go when they don't know where to go. But think about the places where folks have, and they're myriad. Now, there's no limit to the kind of place you'll think of. And then when you think of it, think about what ought to happen. What should happen? Now, you're not going to magically make the funding problem go away for the hospital. But what needs to happen with that guy? You know, what needs to be available to at least give him a thread to hang on to? And then see what you can do to make that happen. Yeah. That'd be the homework. And next time I'm down in Florida, I'll come back. I'm going to get to the ocean one day. I haven't been anywhere but the hotel. I'd love to. This year there's an ocean out there. I'd like to see it. But next time I come down, tell me what you've run into there. Anything you want to take a shot at before we get out of here? Yeah. Well, the problem is, for every one of you, there's 99 others that walk away in disgust. Yep. That's the problem. And you got to do it. Common welfare is what we're about. And so if it worked real well, my God, I'd be all for it. But putting a person in a demeaning kind of a role, so you got to go in apologetically, we feel bad enough already. And so I just think it makes an uphill battle. First member that stayed in our group was a guy. He didn't have any paper, but he came under duress, and he's the only one that's stayed. When we were signing papers, none stayed. That was the only one, our first member. Yeah. So, yeah, once in a great while, an old boss of mine said, "There's some things, everything will work for somebody, but there's nothing that'll work for everybody." And that's true. I mean, I don't care what you do. You could hand leaflets out at the door and get some members. Guarantee it. But you know, it's a matter of how do we want to approach dealing with this problem? And my deal is we can do better. We can do better. Now, if when we get back to the position where we go to the court and say, give us this guy, it's a whole lot different than the judge mandating. So we can do better. That's the point, I think, yeah. Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Hang 1 second. Hey, John, cut, will you? Okay. All right, now.